All right, so I think we're recording now. Great. You see the recording?
Yeah.
Right? Okay, fantastic. All right, hi.
Hey, mate, how are you?
Good, good. How are you?
Not bad, not bad.
So what have you been... Oh, can you introduce yourself to our audience and also tell us what you've been up to lately?
Sure. My name is Deja Miller. Some people know me as the co-director and producer of Islam and the Future of Tolerance. Some people know me for because of Think Inc, which was Australia's largest intellectual touring company, which was an idea I started in, I had in 2010, and it became a reality in 2011. I left that organization a couple of years ago, and I've been actively helping interesting conversations happen. That's pretty much what I do these days.
Yeah, so you're doing that now with the company called, organization called This Is 42?
Yes, so I started This Is 42 just over a year ago with the idea of creating an organization that more or less facilitates great conversation. The original idea included lots of events, and lots of content, podcasts, etc. Now, just before COVID hit, I changed slightly my directions of the organization. So we actually stopped doing events, and then COVID happened, so you can't really do events anyway. And now we are really focused on production of great content. We've got a sizable... two podcasts that has a pretty sizable audience. One is Jay Shapiro's Dilemma podcast, which is a really interesting concept. Full credit to Jay Shapiro for coming up with the concept where you're addressing moral dilemmas. Jay tries to address both sides of moral dilemmas. And each episode... hones in on one moral dilemma, and there's an expert, and then there's season one actually included Coleman Hughes, where there's a back and forth between the two. Season two is more or less just Jay Shapiro and an interviewer interview that he brings in every week. I don't know if it's weekly anymore. I should know. Then we have Conversations with Coleman, which has garnered a very large audience in the recent month or so, due to what is happening in America. Those are the two main things. And thirdly, I haven't really officially announced, but I am working on a new film. We can talk about it down the track.
Announce it now.
Sure. I'm currently working on a project called Better Left Unsaid, which is written by Kurt Jamungle, a Canadian filmmaker. This is his first documentary film. I'm on board as the finishing producer, and it is a political thesis on how the modern political left has come to be. It's the simplest way to put it. Like, it's very easy for, if somebody were to say they need to understand the far right, it's quite easy because their ideology, you know, what they talk about, it hasn't really changed since... a long time ago. The ideology is very clear. Anyone knows it. But if you were to, and I'm not trying to create a false equivalence of far right and far left are the same per se. What I'm trying to say is if somebody were to ask about what does the far left stand for, it's actually not that simple. It's not a clean cut ideology. So this documentary more or less tries to address some of those things and really look into how has the political landscape changed and how is it some people, for example, myself, who considers a liberal as all of a sudden no longer liberal. We are considered in the eyes of the furthest of the left somehow conservative or a completely different ideology that stands against their values. which is an interesting shift because I consider myself a liberal. I'm center left with my most of my political ideologies. And somehow if I am the enemy, or if certain people like say Bill Maher is the enemy, there's something has happened and we don't really, if we haven't figured it out. So the movie tried to explain and look into this in a way that is quite detailed. It is going to have a similar approach to Islam and the Future of Tolerance, where we don't try to withhold info. Like we don't, right now it's sitting at just over 2 hours. We're trying to cut it down, but it is going to be quite an intellectually dense experiment again.
Yeah, that's actually very interesting. And, you know, there's a little bit of relevancy between what you did with Islam and Future of Tolerance and this, because, you know, especially a lot of us ex-Muslims noticed this, because when we, a lot of ex-Muslims that came to Western countries or Australia, Western Europe, or North America, the first thing that a lot of them assumed is that they're going to be welcomed by the left, because their opposition to Islam seemed very anti-right wing naturally to them, right? The opposition to Islamic theocracy, religious governments, and stuff like that. So for a lot of them, at first, like right now, everybody knows this, but at those days, it was a little bit of a shock and a disappointment that, you know, the left was like, no, we don't want you guys. You guys are too, you guys sound actually like the right wing people who talk about Islam and have a problem with Islam. That seemed like politically, that seemed like the left should be their home. And that, you know, the fact that they weren't welcome there to a lot of them seemed like a betrayal and left them politically homeless. So there is some, I don't know. But one thing else that you want to mention, that you said you're a liberal. I consider myself a liberal as well. I'm glad that you didn't submit to this new definitions or call yourself a classical liberal or traditional liberal, because I think that's what happened with feminism, is that a lot of people, given some really extreme claims or activists by feminists, some people are just giving up on the title and you know what, I'm not a feminist, I'm a woman rights activist. And I feel like instead of giving up on that name, they should have just fought for it. They should have been I agree most feminists are not the crazy ones, but the majority of the feminists, they should have been you don't get to take this from us. Feminism has done a lot of good in history, and we're gonna keep fighting for our branding, and just we're gonna disassociate you guys. You minority fringe crazy people don't get to take this brand away from us and run with it. And I think liberals, the term liberal is also something that we should fight for. We shouldn't let some illiberal people who are completely against Enlightenment values all of a sudden take the word liberal and steal it from us, and then we're like, okay, fine, you guys are liberal and we're classical liberals. No, fuck that shit, I'm a liberal, you guys are not the liberals, I'm the liberal.
Sure. It's funny you mentioned that, because I was speaking to speaking on another podcast recently, and I actually did say I think I should categorize myself as a classical liberal, but as I was talking, I didn't really explain myself, and I was thinking about this for a while. Why did I recategorize myself there? And I think you make a valid point. Just recently, I was having a conversation with somebody who was a little uncomfortable that I still hold on to my atheist tag. You're not really an atheist. You're really a Buddhist, was the conversation. I'm like, no, I'm still an atheist. I think you're right. There's we tend to. With that said, sometimes a language change over time, and it's important to understand what has it changed into. It's one of the things we're going to address in the movie, how meaning of certain words have really changed. And you mentioned feminism, and some of your listeners may be aware, I really dived into that subject matter last year head first. And if you're not familiar with the story, I did organize an event called Hashtag Feminism, and I did invite two people who fundamentally disagreed with that, with their position as feminists. And that event turned into a massive debacle, 80,000 plus tweets on a weekend, and a New Yorker magazine article about what happened. So your face tells me you haven't heard what happened.
No, tell me, this sounds okay. Amazing. Okay.
So here's the story, and I have retold this story many times. So this is 42 wanted to facilitate another tough conversation, and it originated from me being at an event, and I was telling somebody that I'm a feminist, and that resulted in a unusual reaction, and I realized my definition of feminism is not the other people there in the room, their definition. For them, the term was more of an insult. It was like I insulted myself by claiming being a feminist. And I was like, wait, when did the term change, and how come I didn't know this? And that's when I started looking into some of the new wave feminists out there. I was familiar with a lot of those names, but I didn't realize that the definition has taken a really odd change at some point. And I was like, okay, I'm still interested in what feminism stands for, and I still consider myself a feminist, and I want to understand this. So I reached out to two people that I've read about the subject matter, who I realized fundamentally disagreed with each other, and on Twitter have tweeted at each other in strange ways where they just, it's very clear they don't like each other. But I thought, just like I did with Sam and Margit, can I facilitate another conversation as such at a live setting? So I invited...
But for people who don't know, you're talking about Sam Harris and Majid Nawaz.
Correct.
But go on. Yeah, okay.
So my documentary tells the story of Sam Harris, the famous atheist,
yeah,
and Majid Nawaz, who, yeah, a reformist Muslim, having a conversation. At the beginning of their conversation, it wasn't a very friendly conversation. As from an ideological point of view, it evolved into something. Watch the movie and you will understand what I'm talking about. So I wanted to do the same thing. So I reached out to a New York Times bestselling author. Well, actually, both of them are New York Times bestselling authors. And one of them has a pretty large audience now. Her name is Roxane Gay. I also reached out to Christina Hoff Sommers. So because they fundamentally have really, really different definitions of what they're talking about, although it is, they talk about feminism, but it's almost like two different languages. So I thought, okay, why don't I facilitate this conversation? So I invited them to come to Australia, and the surprise was that I convinced them. Christina Summers was open from the get-go. You know, Roxane's team weren't sure if she would accept it, but to her credit, she accepted it. And I explained to her what it was all about. I wrote a little, you know, letter saying why I think it's important she partake in this conversation. And they came over to Australia, and we had two events planned, one in Sydney and one in Melbourne. Few things started going wrong at the beginning. We announced the event, and normally when we announce an event, one of the things that I really don't have to worry about is finding a host. For this one, I was struggling to find a host. See, historically, I would announce an event and tons of people email me saying, hey, can I host this? It's very easy, right? But with this one, I didn't get that. And I didn't, initially, it didn't even click in my head. Then we're like a month out, and I was like, okay, I need to start finding hosts. So I start emailing some of the most prominent feminists in the country. This is Australia. And a few of them just did not respond to me, who have in the past. And some of them just came back and said they politely like to decline. And I was like, this is unusual. You should be all over this. And, you know, some of them are people I know. And I reached out to a award-winning journalist, who's a friend of mine. And she just said, look, I won't do it. And I said, okay, you've got to tell me why. She's like, I won't put it in writing. And I'm like, okay, let's catch up for dinner. So I went and caught up with her for dinner, and she told me, if I were to go on that stage and tell what I really feel like, I would lose my job. There is way I will do that in the public. And this is why you're not getting a response. That's one. And the other is some people really don't like Christina Hoff Sommers and they won't share a stage. And then she suggested, you should host it. I'm like, I'm not a host. I've been running events for over a decade. I've never wanted to host. It's not my thing. She said, trust me, you should host. And she gave me a host of reasons why I should host. It didn't, for me, it wasn't interesting. I was not going to do the hosting job at that point. So I continued to reach out to more people. And then some people actually started telling me why they didn't want to host. And again, I'm not going to name out of being a professional. Some very notable feminists locally told me they will not share a stage with Christina Hoff Sommers. And that's when I realized, okay, so we have a problem. Then I started reaching out to some notable journalists and intellectuals, male, and every one of them said no. And then I'm a week out, and I'm like, okay, we're in trouble. We need a host. And then a couple of more people, and I spoke to my team as well, and a couple of more people actually suggested you should really consider hosting it. And reluctantly, I end up hosting the event. And I did tell both Roxanne and Christina, hey, here's the situation. I like to host. Neither of them opposed it. And we come to the Sydney event date. And I go on stage. I tell everyone why I'm there. Because I could imagine the optics. There's 1,000 people in a room. Hashtag feminism is the title. And a man walks out. So I knew the optics were not going to look good. So I explained to them why I'm the host and what has happened. And I hope to be impartial. My role on stage is purely to facilitate a conversation. And so we start the event. And I had the support of the audience at that point. When I announced Christina Hoff Sommers, there was, a few boos here and there. And that set the mood. When I announced Roxanne Gay, the house was just, 80% of the audience was Roxanne Gay. That's when I realized, this is going to be interesting. Right. And we started the conversation. And from the first question, it went way out of control. So my first question, which I still consider is a interesting question to start off. My first question was, Roxanne Gay, what is your definition of feminism? My purpose of my question was I wanted the audience to know her definition of feminism and Christina Hoff Sommers' definition of feminism is potentially not the same. And I wanted to start that as the basis and then go into the details. And the response from Roxanne was something along the lines of, if you don't know the definition, I don't know why you're here. And I realized, this is going to sound real soon. And from there on, that set the mood, and the audience weren't with me. So now, here's the part that you will be very interested in. I went down the line asking all these questions, and I had some support from the audience and whatnot. And then I got to a question where I showed a video clip from one of our public broadcasters in Australia, where it was from Indonesia. The Sharia police were stopping these young girls, 16, 15 young girls, on their mopeds, and they were being stopped by the Sharia police, the modesty police. Now, keeping in mind, all of these girls had the full coverings. Yeah, they were stopped because either their pants were too tight, or their ankles were showing, or something just incredibly trivial, and they were being either being given a fine or being told off. The whole thing was just bizarre. So I showed a small clip. And my
Sharia police from what country? Sorry?
Indonesia.
Indonesia. Okay, good. Sorry.
Yeah. So I followed up with a question. I went to Roxanne and I asked her, do you think feminists in the West have a responsibility to support feminists from Muslim majority countries where things like this, even like Indonesia is presented as, you know, that's the country that had a female prime minister. You know, it's lauded as this progressive country, but it really isn't. So I presented that question, which I thought was a very reasonable question. Roxanne was very unhappy I presented the question, and she thought it was a manipulative question that I've asked. And she basically said, I'm paraphrasing, she said that, who are we to tell them what's right? And the audience just really didn't like me asking that question. Roxanne didn't like that question. And Christina obviously said, absolutely. She gave a more logical answer. Now, keeping in mind, up until that point, I was really pushing Christina Hoff Sommers because she, her position on, you know, campus rape and certain, you know, women's rights issues, I really wanted to challenge her. And there's a moment in that whole interview where some of the data she presented, I really pushed back on it and the crowd clapped. But the moment I asked the Muslim question, I lost the crowd. And from there on, it was just awful. It was just heckling, yelling, screaming at me. I look at 1,000 people just not happy with me for holding Roxanne Gay accountable. And then I want to tell you one more thing that really, really, this defines the whole conversation. We're now in about 45 minutes into the conversation. And I asked Roxanne Gay, who has repeatedly called Christina Hoff Sommers a white supremacist. Right, she has called Roxanne Gay has called Christina Hoff Sommers more than in one occasion. I know this because I organized her to speak to, I believe, Sydney Morning Herald and actually have the recorded interview where she clearly, unequivocally, just, it's not, you know, it's just sort of something in passing, she specifically said, she says she's white supremacist. And I, now that we're, you know, you've shared a stage for about 45 minutes, I said, hey, Roxanne, I've heard you say this a few times. I want to give you an opportunity to potentially clear what you mean by that statement. Do you actually think Christina Hoff Sommers is a white supremacist? That question didn't go down well, and the audience started booing me, and, you know, Roxanne more or less turned away from me on stage, and she said, I can't believe you asked me that question. And I'm like, it's your statement. And basically her response went along the lines of that, you know, she's white supremacy adjacent. So
I've been called that. Yes.
So I don't know what does that make her, because she's literally sitting next to her. Anyway, so all of that turned into a massive nightmare. I don't want to go too much into this anymore into this story because we've taken a bit
of
time.
Where can people find this? This sounds amazing.
Yeah. So right after this, what happened was we finished the event and Roxanne was very upset with me. And the byproduct of that, there's some few things that happened in between, which I, you know, I don't want to bore you with it. It's actually not boring. But so what I want you to do is this. Go to YouTube and type hashtag feminism Roxanne Gay Christina Hoff Sommers. The whole thing is on YouTube. But what I want you to know when you watch this is Roxanne Gay's management tried their level best to stop from this going online. So what they did, I woke up the next day after the event to multiple missed calls, text messages, and emails, each iteration getting more threatening than the one before from her management. Quite simply saying, you are not to post this online. You are not to host the next event. We're going to pick the next host. And then I got a cease and desist letter from her lawyers to not post that thing. So luckily, I know what I'm doing. So there was a contract that she's written, which has given me all the rights to post it online for free. So, you know, there was nothing they could do. And the next day, I started getting phone calls from local media, and two local media published really frustratingly one-sided articles, basically completely demonizing myself and Christina Hoff Sommers and completely excluding Roxanne Gay, basically saying that she deserves better than what happened. And they excluded the part about the legal thread. They excluded the part that her team wanted me to not host, and they handpicked the next host, who told me over the phone. She's never heard of Christina Somers, and she's a lifelong fan of Roxane Gay. So it was, it wasn't fair. So eventually I end up hosting the next event. And we put the two events together because that I wanted to show the full breadth of the conversation. So there's about an hour and a half video on YouTube. It's already has like well over 300,000 views. Watch it.
I will put a link in the description to that video. So people, if you want to check that out, check out the link in the description.
And if that interests you, I highly recommend. There is an article, a very long article, an incredible article from Jesse Single for the New York Magazine, I believe. New York Magazine, rather, where he was so fascinated. He was following the Twitter craziness. And he followed the whole thing. He then spoke to everyone that was involved, not just me, Roxane Gay, and everyone. And he wrote a rather impartial article of really what happened. And it reads like a thriller. It reads like a novel because it was just bonkers. And what I told you is about 50% of what happened. Read the article, watch the clip. It will be a lot of fun.
How did she agree to come to the second part of the debate if she wasn't getting the moderator that she wanted? Like, that seems like strange.
Well, it was a lot of work. There was lots of threats from her team that she would not come to the next event, keeping in mind there was a contractual agreement and a lot of money being paid for her appearance. So there was the issue of what would happen if she breached the contract. And secondly, forget all of that. It's the idea that somehow that she cannot have that conversation with Christina, how the optics will look. And also, I showed her all the questions. I got it pre-approved the next event. I told her there are no surprises. Here are all the questions. I will remove the white supremacy question from the next event. I will remove the Muslim question. So she was. I had to do a lot. I had to make a lot of concessions to make her feel safe and comfortable for the second event.
How is it that you're always on top of the most difficult conversations ever? Like, I remember when you were doing Islam and Future of Tolerance, Islam was the hot topic that people didn't want to touch, and you were like, let's get on this. And that and feminism was like during the Me Too era, that was like a very, like, I mean, it wasn't actually hard to have those discussions if you were on the right side. But if you were on the but any dissent towards what was accepted seemed to be like crushed and attacked mercilessly. And in those environments, you were like, okay, let's make it a documentary, make a debate on that, representing both sides. And now with this whole liberal, what is that one called also?
I don't know. Maybe I'm a bit of a nihilist. Maybe I want to. it's interesting. Like, none of those things. For me, the conscious choice was this. Here's an incredibly difficult conversation. I'm not smart enough to have this conversation. Let me find two people that I respect enough who are having this conversation. Let me facilitate that conversation. For me, it's in a way kind of selfish. I wanted to hear that conversation. Then I thought, I can't be the only one who want to hear it. I mean, that's actually the origins of Think Inc. when I started doing these events, because I was organizing hip hop events, right? But way before that was my origin story of events. And then I thought, I can't be the only one who wants to know the origins of the universe, learn about black holes, understand the surveillance state and all those kind of things. And I organized those events. And these conversations that I'm facilitating are purely coming from my want to learn. Like, okay, I don't understand this. Well, you're a professor of this. You're a professor of this. Okay, that means you have a very long time. You've been looking into the same thing, but you don't seem to agree. Why don't you two have a conversation? I'm sure I'm going to get something out of it, and I'm sure people will get something out of it. And I it's not a conscious choice, but it's a hot button issue right now. Let me tackle it.
But why is it? Why is it? Why isn't it never that simple? Why isn't it that people? Okay, we disagree. Let's talk it out. Why is it? Why does it seem so difficult to have certain conversations? Like, how do people decide that this is too taboo of a topic to even consider the other side? Like, I never understood how is this happening, especially in countries that are supposed to be, you know, the center of free discussion and free expression, where ideas gets evaluated and reevaluated and debated over and over again. These are countries that are supposed to be a role model for how conversations happen for the rest of the planet, and yet even in these countries, certain topics are like considered taboo. And given that the governments in these countries don't have laws, I mean, not as aggressive as some of the other ones that we know of, no blasphemy laws, and more or less they respect free speech, there seems to be an effort to go after people's careers or you know, friends and community in a way to intimidate them into being silent. And I think this is what I really like about what you're doing, because you're taking the heat so that for, you know, you're at the front of the front line, taking a lot of bullets and normalizing a whole bunch of conversations. And then maybe the rest of the people, it will become easier for the other people to follow, right? It's always the most difficult for the first people to have the conversations, you know, that other people might want to have, but they can't because it's just too risky for their careers. Like, some people call them cowards, but I don't think it's fair. I mean, the people like you, for example, that, or me, that have these conversations, I think we can have those conversations because we have less to lose, right? We don't have bosses, or we don't have a whole community or family that will completely abandon us. Maybe we had, and we already abandoned. We already lost them, so we have not much to lose anymore. But is that your motivation? Is that, like, first of all, why is it so difficult to have these conversations? And is you having these promoting these conversations and facilitating them, is your motivation just to make it a little bit easier for the rest of us to have these conversations?
The way I've looked at it throughout my life is there are certain things I want in life, in society. And if I don't see it, I don't see why I can't be the person who does it first. For example, I grew up in the hill country in Sri Lanka, and no one there really was looking at, you know, getting out of that place and going to the big city and then leaving the country. Like, my family, in any generation, I'm the first to really leave to the big city. I'm the first to leave the country. And I'm the first to get into, like, all these things. It's because I didn't see those things happening in my life. I didn't really have anyone to look up to per se. So, and I see the value in those things when dissent is normalized, when conversation, difficult conversation is normalized, I realize how important that is for other people. And because of the courageous voices of the ex-Muslim movement, I see so many people who are having conversations that they weren't having before. And I know because of people like Majid Nawaz and the fact that let's start with Sam. You know, because of Sam and people like Sam, it's much easier to talk about atheism and what does that mean, you know, how to have a meaningful life being an atheist. Because of people like Majid and then the ex-Muslim movement, it's much easier to talk about, to quote unquote, what he said in the movie, the Muslim problem, right? Mm. And things like that we couldn't have said before. And I think for me, first and foremost, to answer why is it difficult, I think it's difficult for an average person to have that conversation because they lack certain financial clout and social clout, right? What I mean by that is, if you're financially depending on really an organization, right? You are not independent, financially independent. You don't decide your financial destiny. You are connected to an organization, etc. So if you then have try to have this difficult conversation, your financial income can easily be taken out, because what has happened in the last, you know, 5-6 years, social media has given everyone a voice, for better or worse, right? So it also has given everyone a simpler and easier way to mobilize. Since the Obama campaign, you know, online mobilization for political operations has been, it's now a fine-tuned art, right? It's very, the mobs were originally created for social good, but at the same time, now, if you're somebody who works for organization X and you are trying to have a difficult conversation, the group of, not a large group, a small group, you know, 50 people, very vocal, can come and chop your legs off from your financial position, right? It may, that thus, then making it, everyone can see that that person now lost their job because of what they said. So that now automatically you're silencing tons of people, which makes it difficult. Secondly, is that you, what becomes widely circulated has become you know, a way of showing your intent. The whole idea of virtue signaling is coming from where you want to appear to, because again, everyone's on social media and you want everyone to know you're a virtuous person, you're doing the right thing. And it's very hard these days to work out what is right. Well, here's a large group of people who support this particular thing, which seemed to be the right thing. So I'm going to say I support. I'm going to put a black square on my Instagram. Now I am showing my support to Black Lives Matter movement. Regardless, do I understand the political underpinnings of that organization and what they really want? It doesn't really matter. I have now said this, right? Mm. Now, once you said that, even if you have certain questions, for example, you just read an article now, it says the data may not support everything BLM is talking about. Now, can you talk about it? No, you can't. You've already told the world that you support the movement and you're worried. So that's why I think it's become incredibly difficult. For me, on the other hand, no one can really take my financial, I've been financially sort of, not necessarily, yeah, independently supporting myself for a long time. And I understand how the business world works. So you can't take it away from me and you can't cancel me. So that's why I'm ready to take the bullets.
So it seems to me that it's not really about, for a lot of people, it's not really about knowing what is true and figuring out how to help. For a lot of people, it seems to be, where's my tribe? How do I find who's inside my tribe? How do we identify who's outside, who's the enemy of our tribe? And how do I signal to my tribe that I'm a hero by going as aggressively as I can against the enemy of my tribe? Like, how do I send those signals so I can be accepted in my tribe as a valued member? I think, like, especially since religion used to be the main tool to do that, as the more the role of religion gets reduced in our society, people find other ways to try to belong to a tribe, to feel like they belong to a tribe, and also to signal to their tribe that they're a valued member of that tribe, right? So it's not about like saving Black lives or figuring out what the actual truth is. It's about, okay, these are the lines that people in my tribe use. These are the lines that people, that if they say it, they probably are the enemy of my tribe, and I have to like be stronger than the other people in my tribe against them to show them that I'm a hero. And I don't know how to solve some. If sometimes it seems like we are trying to solve this problem by telling people, well, this is actually the truth. You guys are not looking at what the truth is. But if they're not even looking for what the truth is, is that really the solution, right? If the desire that people are trying to satisfy is this lack of belonging, or this being not being valued and wanting to be part of something bigger than themselves, and we don't want them to do that with religion because religion promotes falsehood, now maybe they're like clinging on to something else that promotes some false information. Is the answer something beyond just like, here's the right information? Is the answer also like, here's a healthy way to for you to satisfy the desire to belong to a tribe or something like that? Is that like I think a lot of people are having intellectual conversations, but is there a piece that is missing in this whole?
I think it's an interesting question. Just before this podcast, I was actually speaking to a vice president of a university, a Catholic university from America. And it was an interesting conversation. I've never spoken to this person. It was a reverend. And he was having a challenging time hiring somebody for a particular position. I don't want to give away too much because it was a confidential conversation. But the point is, when I was listening to him, it reminded me he would be what we would call a classical or what a conservative used to be, or a center-right mind would used to be, right? And then I saw the other day there was a tweet that went viral where someone, I forgot who it was, who said, if you don't, I'm paraphrasing, if you don't have a conservative friend, or if you haven't had a meaningful conversation with a conservative, you may be part of the problem. And the comments on that was just horrid. If you look at the data, Americans are more scared and more fearful of their political opponent than anyone else in the world. They're not really scared about North Korea, Russia, or anyone else, but rather the political opponent, right? So this goes to the point of the tribal mentality, right? Mm. And the tagline for This Is 42 is find meaning. I saw this happening a few years ago, maybe 3-4 years ago. And I realized, when the New Atheism movement started in 2001, and then for the next decade, you Richard Dawkins and Sam Harris's, Dennett's and Hitchens were really going after religion. And I was, back then I would call myself easily a militant atheist, right? We were just shaming religious people. I remember this poor middle-aged woman who had an argument with me in Melbourne streets about, I think, Mormonism or something like that, who wanted to preach it to me. And, by the end of that conversation, she was in tears. And I thought, yeah, I won. But I don't think I won anything there in that argument. I may have made her, worldview shatter, but I think she would have gone further into that religion as a result of that conversation. I think to the point that you're saying, I think the missing part, and I'm not necessarily saying that I know I have answers, but I do think there is definitely a missing part. It is that what religion offered. See, I know a lot of people do, and to a certain point in my life, I did as well. We used to brand religious people as more or less just a bunch of idiots, right? There's a point where we thought, if you're believing in all these things, man, you have to be completely crazy. Flying horses and talking snakes, like none of that is really real. But there is an element of religion that speaks to that sort of yearn for transcendence that people want to, that's why now traditional religions have gone down. But if you look at the popularity of New Age stuff and this tribalism stuff that's happening from different camps, whether it is the BLM movement or any of these social justice movements, they are growing. So the vacuum that people want to find meaning, they're not getting it from anything. And religion generally most religions paint good and evil, very simple, black and white. You are good finding evil. Jesus is Satan, or God is Satan. Very, very simplistic view, right? And if you look at most of these movements, they actually tell the same thing. And John McWhorter basically said, more social justice movements are religions on their own. If you look at, the modern feminist movement, you're against us, you're for or against us. The trans rights movements, all of them, BLM movement, for the most part, there are no nuanced conversation. You're a righteous warrior fighting for. You're the hero. You're the protagonist. You're the hero. You are fighting against this evil. and all of these people. And that's why there's so much emotion when they come at you, you know, when something happens. And that's why they just get behind it. And I think if we were to show people that we are all shades of gray, the idea of evil being this black thing and you know, good being this white thing, it's a myth. The human condition doesn't operate like that. Sure, there are things that we can easily say. Anyone can say, that is wrong, right? But understanding this, and I think the reason why we are struggling with having these conversations is we're trying to make it too simple.
But isn't that what people want? And I mean, what's the solution?
I don't think the reason that somebody would listen to this conversation, we've been talking for about closer to an hour now, right? The reason why people listen to Joe Rogan for 3 hours, this idea that people want, I think that myth has been widely debunked. I agree in certain elements, say like on a tweet, at certain formats, the shorter, the better. But if we normalize this kind of difficult conversation and it is widely available everywhere, I think we have the ability to shift the narrative. We have the ability to give...
I'm pessimistic because I think a lot of people watch, you know, the success maybe of people listening to long podcasts or coming to your events, and we look at them and see like, oh my God, this is a lot of people. We're making a lot of progress. But it's really not, I mean, to us seems like a lot of people, but that's still a small fraction of society, right? Like most people will never be into looking at research, listening to very long intellectual discussions. No matter how big your audience is, that still is going to be a very, very small fraction of the world. People just changing their profile picture or just using a hashtag or just retweeting a tweet that took them 5 seconds to read, that's always going to be the norm. And that's always going to be the majority of the people. And I think like we cannot expect human nature to change. This has been human nature. Like even if you go back to ancient Rome, you know, emperors were like, let's just give them some games to entertain them with, and then they're gonna forget that they're hungry or something, right? Like it has always been like distracting people or giving them simple, you know, virtue signals and stuff like that. It has always been. It's just part of how our brain operates. And I think a lot of us that are hoping for more is that because we have achieved more, and we think other people can do more as well, but I don't think most people can. And because they can't, it doesn't mean we shouldn't abandon them. I think we have to come up with a solution that also appeals to the majority. And if the majority is looking for a tribe, why not give them a tribe that is based on reality and based on facts and based on real solutions? Well, one thing I want to see is maybe you would be interested in at some point, because you're better at branding and marketing and creating events and stuff. Why not create a tribe based on enlightenment values, values that we have seen that works and brings the highest number of people out of misery, and you know, has responsible for healthier societies and countries that have progressed faster than others. These are values that we don't have to, like, we know based on data and experience that they work. Why not turn that into its own tribe with its own simple narratives and its own signals for people to understand that they belong to this tribe? And just make it cool and to belong to this tribe. Make it, like, make people give a sense of belonging. To come up with a branding in a way to for you to identify that this is your tribe. Do you think, like, that would work? That would be, I mean, I've been thinking about that.
I don't know if one tribe can really work, because after a certain point, it becomes too big. For example, TED conference was created with a similar ideology, right? And now TED is so big, no one really considered it to be really a tribe. But if you look at the beginning, how they, you know, what the idea Chris had, it's kind of like the direction. I think it can't be one thing. I think it needs to be a range of, you know, customized to certain areas and certain people. I mean, Joe Rogan has a tribe, Ben Shapiro has a tribe.
Those tribes are based on a person and a personality and a person that they're following, right? I'm talking about a set of ideas.
But is that the problem, part of human nature you were talking about? We tend to look up to other humans for guidance, right? As some humans have then claimed their divinity, but ultimately, we tend to sort of follow people.
Right, but I think even if we're following a person, I want people to follow the person because of the ideas behind that person. Like, I think the person that has done that the best is Martin Luther King, right? The person goes away, but the ideas keep on after. Like, I think that's why he was so successful, because he came up with certain ideas that people felt like, okay, this is my tribe. And it outlived them, right? But and the problem with
MLK, I think it's important that people realize that, you know, when he was alive, lots of his ideas weren't as popular as you may think it is right now. Because his popularity, really, the way the world sees who he is and all of his ideologies, that level of popularity came after. So, right, you know, this, we're looking at history, we're looking at MLK in retrospect.
Yeah, and the problem with TED is that it's not a problem, it's a good thing to have, but it's not what I'm talking about, because it's about, those are just having every kinds of conversation, which is always good. But what I'm talking about, because you cannot feel like you're part of a tribe is if all sides are being represented, right? For you to feel like you belong to a tribe, we have to be like, no, this is your side. The other people who disagree with you are out of this tribe, right?
Isn't that the problem that you were addressing in the first place? I mean, isn't that what already happening? Like, people are going into their own little tribes, but the problem is anyone can create a tribe now. So if you believe in flat earth, flat earth society exists for you. That is your tribe.
But the thing is that I wish people didn't require that, but it seems like, I think like this is just this is how our brain is wired. And it's not like we can't be like, oh, people stop being tribal. It seems like me and you don't need it. And to me, it seems like the people who don't need it, they don't get people who do. And you can't go tell people like, hey, stop being straight or stop being gay or stop liking food or stop enjoying, I don't know, drinking water. To me, it seems like when we tell people, the one of us who don't get what is the feeling behind being tribal, to me, it might be, if we want people to be less tribal, to me, it seems like we're asking them to go against a fundamental part of how their brain is wired, and that might be impossible. And the next best solution is to give them a side, but a tribe, to be like, this is the tribe that we belong to, and everybody else is outside of this tribe. But at least make it a tribe that is based on values that has made the world a better place. You know what I mean? That is based on reality. It's not based on myth, based on fiction, based on data that is not, based on information that is not, agreeable with data and research. Maybe something like that. What do you think?
I mean, look, I think you're already doing it. You've created a tribe, you know, millions of people. And in a small way, I was trying to do the same thing. I think we have the same intention. You know, when I was running Thinkgeek, I called it a movement. The idea wasn't really, idea was to get various minds so people can rally behind the ideas under one umbrella. So, you know, we're all trying to do that. But the reality is we're not the only one who are trying to do that. There are lots of people trying to do it. So I think there's lots and lots of tribes being created right now. And I think we shouldn't fight against this innate human condition. I agree with you with regards to, we should facilitate that with people who want to belong to a tribe. But that what we could do is, for me at least, I want, the most important thing for me is for people to have a curious mind and wanting to learn things. And it doesn't matter how taboo it may be, you know, just to have that curiosity. So for me, and what I've dedicated my life is to be a facilitator, create things that get people thinking. Now, you mentioned earlier something, and I was thinking, it's not as narrow as you may think it is. For example, Islam and the Future of Tolerance has clocked over a million views on, it's like 1.3 million views in about 8 months on Amazon Prime. If the opportunity is available and people can, it doesn't matter how difficult the subject is, and if they can privately have access to it, they will access it. And I think that explains some of these, you know, why does Joe Rogan have such a following? It's because it's okay to have any conversation. And I think, look, going back to the point, I agree, facilitating a tribe will help, but I don't know if we can specifically say you belong to this tribe. You know what I mean? And there are a lot of organizations that are grounded in the Enlightenment values. If we can normalize that conversation, normalize those values in conversation, and it is in your face, it can't be just one thing. It has to be documentaries, it has to be books, it has to be podcasts, it has to be mainstream television, it has to be mainstream film, music. That's how you then eventually make it rather normal.
Let me add some pessimism to that optimistic view.
Sure.
So one thing I've noticed, you mentioned about how you like the ex-Muslim community and the fact that they're normalizing dissent and stuff like that. It seems to me like once you do that with one topic, it doesn't automatically translate to anything else. And I have recently come out and said some things against a lot of people in the BLM movement, and have made some points that should be even agreeable even by people on all sides, but it seemed like it was some obvious post that got me into a lot of trouble. And I have been shunned by a lot of ex-Muslims, right? I have been kicked out of a whole bunch of ex-Muslim communities for that, right? Which is interesting I have been removed from a lot of ex-Muslim communities for my views on BLM. And I've been left by a whole bunch of my ex-Muslim so-called friends. It seemed like the flag that they're waving is that they want to normalize dissent the same way that they did with Islam. And it seems like normalizing dissent for them means supporting BLM. And I don't think they're noticing the irony in kicking me out of these groups questioning that. My God.
This is something I noticed even in the atheist community. Just because you rejected superstition doesn't necessarily mean you are rejecting bad ideologies. I've seen that in the atheist movement many times over, where people completely take on ideologies that are like, ooh, you know, I didn't think you would think along those lines. Again, when I say normalizing dissent, I got the term from the ex-Muslim community, but I'm talking about dissent in all ideas. I'm sorry that you got that pushback, but that's going to be part and parcel of your job.
No, I know, but I'm not like complaining about it. I actually kind of like, you know, saying things that other people do not dare say, and I completely accept the backlash. But what I was suggesting was not like nagging about it. What I'm suggesting is that these are people who have experienced what it's like to dissent, and what it is like to experience a pushback from community, and they are waving the flag of normalizing dissent, and it seems like, no, you're not tolerant of dissent, right? You claim to be wanting to normalizing dissent, but so what I'm saying is that even when you're successful in promoting normalizing dissent in one topic, they will start once they find their tribe. I, you know, they were like, I'm normalizing dissent because I'm against this, but once I find my tribe, now dissent is not accepted if it's against my new tribe. What?
Absolutely. So dissent is still okay for them within the ex-Muslim movement. That's fine. Right. Anything beyond that, once they, you're absolutely right. And then that is something that happens. And this is why, for me, tribes don't necessarily work, because I feel like they stagnate after a certain point. They don't evolve. And you know, that's why, you know, okay, I've spoken about the Islam ideology in this, and I genuinely have seen progression in that conversation, notable progression globally, and feminism, I haven't really seen a real conversation. I feel like it's still at this very choppy place, and I think with BLM though, I am seeing some real conversation happening. My good friend Coleman Hughes is presenting some incredible arguments, and it's very well thought out. And that is, I know that because I'm working with Coleman very closely. So I know the sheer number of people that is listening to him, following him, emailing him, calling him. He's definitely helping people have better conversations about that particular subject matter.
Man, I think people think Coleman Hughes is big. I'm telling them, you have no idea where he's going heading. Like, he's like a rising star. I think, really? Like, I just listening to him reminds me about the experience that we had many years ago, for a lot of us, discovering Sam Harris for the first time. And I feel like, I think Coleman Hughes is going to be I hope Sam is not ever going to hear this. Probably he won't. But I think he's going to be a better version of Sam Harris. So,
I'll give some credit to Sam, because Sam has been a bit of a mentor to Coleman. And Sam is always,
I know.
Kept his phone lines available to Coleman. But you're right. I mean, you know, I am helping. I'm putting together the infrastructure for Coleman to thrive. And Coleman is just very early in his career and his trajectory. You know, you are witnessing, you know, a genius in the work, and he's an extraordinary mind. You have a question.
How, at the time. How are you doing so many things, and what are you going to do next? Like, you seem to be everywhere.
Yeah. So I have this habit. I'm not content with just doing that one thing. Right now, I am working on basically Coleman's career. There's a lot of moving parts I've put together for Coleman. I am working on this documentary, Left Unsaid. I'm working on the next iteration of This Is 42. I have a grand, ambitious plan I've been working on for about 8 months. It's in the work. It's not ready for anyone to know what is happening, but I can tell you it is going to be something when it comes out. Hopefully around early November I'll be able to go public with it, but I am This Is 42 as an organization will have a relatively singular focus at a certain point. And we're going
can't
to
tell us even what the topic is at all, like, not even
I've given plenty of hints through this podcast conversation. It wouldn't be one thing, it would be multiple disciplines, but it would be, hopefully, it would be incredibly helpful for people all around the world, what we plan to do. Those are the three
main... Can you come and tell us every time you have a new project? Can you come and talk about it?
Absolutely. Okay. I really appreciate that, you know, you what you do, what you have been doing for years. So I'll be happy to let you know what we're doing. And when I'm ready, I'll send you the trailer for Better Left Unsaid. You can share it with your audience. I think it will, I'm telling you right now, it will make people very uncomfortable. I am going to be again on the front lines for even doing this. But I genuinely believe, you know, I actually, to a certain degree, I disagree with the conclusion of this movie. I actually disagree. But I am doing it because I want to facilitate a good faith attempt by a writer director who is trying to dive headfirst into a very difficult conversation. And if we don't help those conversations happen, the extreme version of that conversation will take center stage. So I'm willing to put my name onto this conversation and help it gain a lot more eyes, purely because it is important to have this conversation.
Right now, there's nowhere people could go find anything about Better Left Unsaid right now. Are you going to announce it later?
There are some information that is available if you go on YouTube, early remnants of what the project was going to be from the director. And you can see all that information. But the final product will be slightly different. You know, this is where I come in. This is why my services were originally requested. So polish it to be a different project. But yeah, you can go look it up. And we will go public soon. We might need a little bit of help to finish it off. You can search, if you have any listeners in Australia right now, you can actually help. We are part of DAF, which is Documentary Australia Foundation, which means you get a tax credit if you help us make this movie. It's on DAF website. Internationally, we haven't really gone out and asked for any help. We might need it, but we might not. I'm in the process of just putting those things together.
And where can people follow you and find your
I'm on Twitter. I'm just search my name, Desha Miller. I am very easily reachable. I'm quite receptive. It's just like I said earlier, my previous conversation with somebody who wanted some hiring advice. If I have time, I'm available.
Fantastic. Can you actually send me all the links to yourself and all the projects, and also for people who might want to support Better Left Unsaid, all the links where can they could find these things and stuff?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay, absolutely. Fantastic. This was such a fun discussion. Thank you so much for having it with me.
No worries, man. Thank you so much for thinking of me. And I look forward to, you know, setting this up, this conversation up with Coleman. It would be a fascinating conversation. His next few podcasts. I mean, we just released a podcast with Neil deGrasse Tyson.
My God, that was amazing.
It's it's only going to get better. The people we've got lined up. There's actually a solo podcast coming up where he's really gotten all of his thoughts about the BLM movement, and he's going to talk about it for about half an hour, and that would really give you a lot of people who are trying to have this conversation the language and the data they need to have that conversation better.
Right. And I have your word that you will come back on this show to talk to tell us. Okay. I had to make sure I have that on record. So thank you for that.
You have it on record. I'll be here again. Thank you, mate. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Okay.
Take it easy.
Bye.
All good?
Yep. Let me stop recording. Okay.